If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them.
Welcome to Beyond the Bubble. I'm Kristen Roberts, Washington editor for the 30 news organizations all around America that together make McClatchy. Every week, we call reporters and political operatives who live and work in battleground states and ask them to tell us how voters are reacting to Donald Trump and Republican Washington, and what issues Americans outside the Beltway are thinking about that D.C. still is not. This week, Alex Rorty and I will be talking about Facebook, Russian ads, and how candidates and voters are working hard to not get duped in 2018. Alex Rorty, welcome back to the podcast studio.
I'm thrilled to hand over the hosting duties to you once again after your 1 week break.
I'm going to start taking more breaks. You did very, very well.
I don't know. I was a little nervous, but you know, with our trusty producer Davin Coburn to guide us, I think things went okay.
Davin makes lemonade from lemons every single week,
and I give him a lot of lemons. So
all
it's
right,
good.
What do you want to talk about?
I want to talk about fake news, Russia, and Facebook.
I want to talk about those things, too. And to do it, we're going to interview Ben Weider. He's our investigative reporter here at McClatchy. And we're also going to talk with Aaron Shirokman of PolitiFact about what that fact-checking organization is doing to help voters sort the real from the not real in 2018.
And then we'll go to the lightning round, where we identify politicians making moves for 2018.
All right, let's go.
January 20th. The day the people became the rulers of this nation again.
And our ideals and fundamental values are being attacked. Do we retreat or do we fight? I say we fight.
He heard those voices that were out there that other people weren't hearing, and he just earned a mandate.
It is time for Democrats to grow a backbone and get out there and fight.
The American people would like to try something new. We would like to see the country go in a different direction to change the course for America.
He doesn't take this presidency seriously enough.
So to all Americans, hear these words. You will never be ignored again.
Alex, let's say hello to a newbie. His name is Ben Weider. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you. Very, very excited to be here. Big fan. Glad to make my debut.
Oh, big fan.
Big fan.
Exactly.
Wow, he's buttering
he's
us
doing.
Up. Yeah.
All
well
right,
done,
Ben. We want you to tell us all about what happened on Facebook by the Russians in 2016 and what it means for 2018. So why don't you catch all of our listeners up? What did Russia buy in 2016?
So Russia bought a number of ads on Facebook, and Russians are accused of having created a number of bots, which are basically automated programs, automated social media accounts that amplified messages during the 2016 election. Last week, House members released a trove of Facebook ads showing some of what the Russians were purchasing. And it's clear from the accounts they were using, the types of ads they were purchasing, that they were putting out very socially divisive material and trying to kind of increase divisions that ultimately were, for the most part, favoring Donald Trump.
It's really interesting when you look at some of the ads that have come out through the congressional investigations into Russian activity in 2016. If you look at the breadth of the issues that these Russian operatives were touching upon, it wasn't just overtly pro-Trump stuff. There was a lot of stuff related to or purported to be a part of the Black Lives Matter movement, for example.
Exactly. Yeah. We see ads about Black Lives Matter. We see ads about immigration issues. We see LGBT related ads. They were basically hitting on all the kind of social touch points and all the things that people get really fired up about politically and just kind of throwing gas on that fire. And the impact is that, you know, a message that might have gotten a few notices or a little bit of attention is amplified. And you know, what we also know is that members of the Trump campaign inadvertently, perhaps, were actually promoting some of this material and retweeting this material. And it was very sophisticated. The ability of, you know, some guy maybe sitting in a basement in the Ukraine or somewhere in Russia to be able to understand the nuance of the Black Lives Matter movement is pretty incredible when you think about it. I certainly wouldn't be able to weigh in on the nuances of, you know, divisive social issues in Russia. And we've seen a lot of scrutiny in recent weeks as lawyers, primarily from social media companies, from Twitter, Facebook, from Google, came down to Capitol Hill basically to be browbeaten by members of Congress for not doing a better job of flagging this material that was suspicious.
Senator Franken, how did Facebook, which prides itself on being able to process billions of data points, somehow not make the connection that electoral ads paid for in rubles were coming from Russia? How could you not connect those two dots?
After the fact now, they say, oh, there's all this material that we've seen. But, you know, even in the immediate aftermath of the election, they were claiming just didn't happen.
You know, I was so struck by, you say sophisticated, Ben. It was almost creative, some of these ads. They had a Bernie coloring book that they showed. And I think that was focused on LGBT issues.
Extraordinary command, not only of the language, but the culture.
Right. I mean, in a way that I think, you know, there are a lot of people in the United States who couldn't do that. I think there are a lot of people who get paid to do that sort of thing for a living who wouldn't think to do that. You know, Ben, what districts were targeted with these kind of messages?
We know that a lot of swing districts were often the ones that were targeted, you know, swing districts that were decisive in helping to decide the election. And that's why there are a lot of questions about whether anyone from the campaign would have been feeding any information to the people creating this material to give them a heads up of, you know, here are some areas you might want to target, here are some issues you might want to target. You know, that's one of the big questions that is out there as the special counsel continues to look into Russian interference in the 2016 election, because on the surface, it's hard to imagine that these things could have happened just on their own. And certainly for us, that's one of the things we are very heavily tracking.
So you referenced that these tech giants were called to Washington to testify. Mm-hmm. Let's listen to Mark Zuckerberg. This is him actually speaking in late September when he's announcing the release of these Russian ads to investigators.
I don't want anyone to use our tools to undermine democracy. It is a new challenge for internet communities to have to deal with nation states attempting to subvert elections. But if that's what we must do, then we are committed to rising to the occasion.
Democrats and Republicans alike really are not very impressed with America's tech industry right now and their ability to, or even their perhaps their willingness to play policeman on their platforms. They're looking at 2018 at this point. What are the threats that the campaigns are facing in 2018 from Kremlin-backed operatives?
What we know is that these threats are materializing already. In today's gubernatorial race in Virginia, a group supporting the Democratic candidate, Northam, put out a report recently indicating that they believe that a network of bots, perhaps Russian-backed, we don't know exactly the origin of it, but that a group of bots did kind of similar things to what we saw in the 2016 election. There was an ad put out by a group supporting Northam that attacked Republican opponent Ed Gillespie for some of his positions, particularly on immigration and for, you know, his sort of implicit support for keeping up monuments and kind of hit him as, you know, the ad has a guy driving around in a truck waving a Confederate flag. And this report indicates that a number of bot-like social media profiles were out there spreading this message. So already in this Virginia race, we're seeing a lot of the same things that we saw in 2016. And I think it has a lot of people concerned that this is what we're going to see in 2018.
Well, that's what Richard Burr has already warned us all about. Let's listen to the chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee talking about the expanding Russia probe, possibility of collusion, and what's happening in 2018.
That the Russian intelligence service is determined, clever, and I recommend that every campaign and every election official take this very seriously as we move into this November's election and as we move into preparation for the 2018 election.
Alex, are campaigns prepared for this? Are they doing anything?
I think campaigns are preparing in earnest for this. The way one person put it to me, look, Russia got a great return on its investment in the 2016 election. They spent very little money and threw the election into chaos, not just during the election, but in the aftermath. We're all here talking about it. So they're absolutely ready for this to happen again. And it's interesting. There was a group, Priorities USA. You might remember them. They were Hillary Clinton's super PAC. So they saw a lot of this up close last year. There's an effort underway within that group to both figure out how can we track these sort of messages from Russia or just fake news, period, more broadly, And then how do we deploy countermeasures? It was really fascinating talking with a spokesman for the group over the phone. You know, there was this acknowledgement that even if they are able to track, which is no guarantee, I should be clear, they're not even sure that they're able to do this. This is, in fairness, very technically tricky to do. Even if they are able to track it, they're not sure what the countermeasures are, because there's some evidence, they told me, that if you tell people that it's fake news, it actually drives them even further into believing it. You know, it's not just as simple as doing running a fact check.
We are such a conspiracy-minded population.
I mean, it really says that we could have a whole segment about the sort of psychology of the voter when it comes to something like this.
Good idea. Next week. That's your assignment.
Next week. We'll start now figuring out some guests. One thing you have seen a lot of Democratic groups do, this is related to Russia, they've improved their security. And I think people are preparing for this binge of fake news from Russia or whoever. But I think there's still a lot of uncertainty about what that looks like and how that works. To me, it's like, you know, we talk about campaigns and we focus on the candidates and we focus on the parties. A few years ago, we had to start focusing on the super PACs and outside organizations who had a huge effect on elections. Now I feel like we're having to look at foreign adversaries and their involvement in elections. And what does that say? What are they trying to do?
It says the United States of America is finally having to confront some of the same challenges as other countries have been confronting for decades, with foreign adversaries dipping in and out of their electoral processes. Ben, what's your prediction here? How much will these Russian propagated ads on Facebook define the 2018 campaign cycle?
I think it really depends on what happens between now and then. And you know, there's a bill that was introduced, a bipartisan bill introduced by Senator Amy Klobuchar from Minnesota, by John McCain, Republican from Arizona, that would seek to treat some of these social media companies like Facebook sort of how TV stations are treated, in requiring greater disclosure of political ads. If we see something like that actually take effect, then, you know, that could have a chilling effect on the ability of foreign influence in these elections, or at least, you know, it would require people to do things a little differently. If nothing changes, then I think if the Virginia example is any indication, it's hard to imagine there won't be any influence in some of these races.
Yeah, here's the thing to watch: how much money Facebook and Google put against that bill.
Right, right. And, you know, it's interesting to note the Paradise Papers, the latest version of Panama Papers yesterday, showing the way that significant amounts of Russian money has made its way into some of these tech firms. So that's another open question that, you know, we might be discussing.
Well, I should emphasize priorities for all the work that they're doing, trying to track and then figure out how to deploy countermeasures against these ads. They say, full stop, we need the tech companies to do this, that what we're doing is a half measure at best. Even if it's successful, we need Facebook and Twitter to cooperate. And I don't know that they're necessarily very optimistic that that's going to happen.
All right, Alex, let's switch gears here just a little bit.
President-elect, since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance? You are attacking our news organization. Can you give us a chance to ask a question, sir?
Go ahead.
Sir,
I'm not going to give you a question.
Can you stay categorical?
You are fake news.
Sir, can you stay?
Same topic, different interview. Who is Aaron Shirokman?
So Aaron Shirokman is an editor at PolitiFact, which is a Pulitzer Prize-winning fact-checking organization that really, if you're an average voter, this is who you go to sort out what's fake and what's real.
And if you're an average journalist, too, we all rely on PolitiFact a lot.
Absolutely.
All right, Davin, let's call him.
This is Aaron.
Hi, Aaron. It's Kristen. How are you?
Hey, Kristen. How are you? I'm doing well.
Really well. Thanks for joining us here, Alex.
Aaron, how are you doing? It's Alex Rorty.
Hey, Alex. Doing well. Thanks. Nice to meet you.
Aaron, can you please paint the picture for our listeners of 2016 and PolitiFact's role? What did you do in 2016 and how well did you do it?
Yeah, well, we did a lot of fact-checking. I think at the end of the day, we fact-checked President Donald Trump more than 350 times, Hillary Clinton a little shy of that, close to 300 times. We analyzed a lot of claims, looked at a lot of numbers. I think the one thing that people really wanted in 2016 was fact-checking in real time on demand. And so we did a lot of work, obviously, during the presidential debates and during the conventions. We, I think, did some really important work. We, for instance, helped debunk one of President Trump's first ads. He saw where there was a video of people pouring in through the borders. He was trying to make the claim that it was Mexico. It was not. He said it was intentional to show what it could look like, but clearly it was just a deceptive ad practice. We helped, along with other members of the media, look at President Trump's more nuanced record and position on the supporting or not supporting the war in Iraq. And certainly with Hillary Clinton's email claims, I think we did a lot of good reporting helping readers, viewers, and voters kind of better understand what was true about some of those attacks and what was false. And so I think we saw our page views double in 2016. I think a lot of people were interested in the truth, even though many people, I guess, are saying we're living in this post-truth world.
I'm really glad that you raised that, because I think it's something that political journalists like to say. We're in this post-fact or post-truth environment. Do you think that's true?
I don't, to be honest. I think we've been post-truth for many, many years or forever. I think it's different right now. I think the spread of information online, particularly on Facebook, but also on Twitter and through Google searching, has made it maybe feel like it's more, that there's less truth out there. But the reality is, when it comes to politics, since the start of time, there's been lying and misinformation involved. It's just the platform has now changed, because everyone can be a publisher of information, because if you have a phone, you can be a journalist in some ways.
Walk us through your scale. How do you get to Pants on Fire?
Yeah, sure. So we at PolitiFact, we have six ratings. They start at true, and it goes downwards there to half true, mostly false, false, and then Pants on Fire. The reality is, at PolitiFact, every fact check that we write, we've written more than 14,000 now in 10 years, they're ultimately vetted by a panel of three editors. And those editors make the decision. It's not the writer. The writer makes a recommendation, but ultimately it's the editors, the journalists who sit in a room and kind of debate the issues. In some cases, that could be a two-minute conversation. A lot of times it's very simple. So if Donald Trump said, for instance, we're the highest taxed nation in the world.
The taxes are crazy. The highest taxed nation in the world. We're going to turn that around very quickly.
We know for a fact that's incorrect, and we can dispatch with that pretty quickly. But there's a lot of times when, quite frankly, the world is very gray, and we could spend 30 minutes, 45 minutes discussing really what we want to rate something. Pants on Fire is usually left, obviously, for the worst statements. That's something that is not only false, but either very wrong or potentially damaging, or something that's, someone would know it's false and is potentially maliciously pushing a misleading falsehood. So that's kind of the difference between Pants on Fire and false. But a lot of scrutiny goes into everything that we publish.
Aaron, I want to ask you, do you think, looking back to 2016, that you did enough to dissect real from fake news?
Alex, the answer is probably not. I think we were certainly aware of stories like the Pope endorsed Donald Trump. For the most part, we ignored them because we expected that people understood that it was not true, that these were falsehoods. And so we spent our time, and there was certainly a lot to do, to fact-checking the claims made by Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton themselves. As we pivoted off the election, I think we realized that there certainly was so much misinformation out there that people were believing at least some of it. And so we realized that we could do more, and we are doing more. We essentially put a full-time fact checker on this problem right after the election, and realized that if people are having trouble telling if something's true or false, that's a perfect spot for a fact checker to come in and help. Even if, to us, in some cases, we thought like, oh my gosh, everyone would know this was wrong. The reality is that the fake news operators are getting very good at selling disinformation in a way that looks like real news.
It sounds like a real shift for your business model, though, too, right? I mean, you're talking about taking reporters who are normally looking at campaign ads or listening to the words of a candidate and fact-checking them in near real time, or you know, as close as you can get to that, and then putting them on a completely different task, which is assessing the truthiness, if you will, of some article or some piece of content.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a change for us. We did some of this actually in the early years of PolitiFact when it was the chain email. So the chain email was the original kind of fake news for us.
The chain email, that's a great example.
And they were pretty easy to tell they were false because they were all caps and they made all these kind of outlandish claims. These purveyors of fake news have gotten way more sophisticated and in many ways have mimicked what traditional journalists do, and as such have created huge issues. So in reality, we have shifted a focus from fact-checking kind of deep, intense policy debates. We're still, of course, doing that, but really kind of doing this kind of urban myth-busting, in a la Snopes, which is kind of more known for this. But obviously, it's entered the political realm so much that it feels like we have no choice but to try to do our part to help people understand what's real and what's not.
I mean, Aaron, that was going to be my question for you. If you're just the average voter sitting at home listening to this podcast, Are there any tells for fake news, that, like any easy way for people to at least suspect that that might be, this might not be
That's
real?
A good question.
I have a couple that I think are real important. The first thing I would look at, and this is a subtle thing, but most real news outlets will credit their photos. So if you see a photo online, you should look to see, do they credit who took that photo or where did that information come from? The second thing is kind of in the same vein. Is there a clear byline that some, do you know, are you able to tell who wrote this story? Are you able to tell when they wrote it and when they published it? And can you contact them? Those are all good indications that this is more likely to be real. And if you don't see that information, I'd worry about that. The third thing I would say is, any real good mainstream news outlet has a pretty detailed About Us page where you're going to learn a little bit more about this publication. Fake news operators kind of either don't, or they kind of have an About Us page that is really lacking. So I would look at those three things. Actually, if you go to PolitiFact.com, we have a 10-question quiz that anyone could take. You can put in any URL and kind of go through 10 questions. And I feel after those 10 questions, you'll know if this is a story you can trust or you should be wary of.
God, that's a good idea.
Yeah.
That is really useful. It strikes me, though, Aaron, that if you're just doing the fact checks, how are you going to get them to people? I mean, so much of what we saw making the rounds in 16 and that we're worried about making the rounds in 18 is going to happen on a platform you don't own. It's going to happen on Facebook. Is Facebook cooperating with you?
Yeah, so we are. We've been working with Facebook basically since December of last year to help root out fake news on Facebook. And so basically what we're doing is we're kind of the doing fact checks for Facebook. Their users can now flag any story that they see in their newsfeed as potentially being fake. We then get access to the list of those potential URLs that are fake, and we do our fact-checking process, the same fact-checking process, whether we're fact-checking Donald Trump, Hillary Clinton, it doesn't matter. But if we determine that that story that a reader or a Facebook user sent us is fake, Facebook then takes it and kind of downranks it on its page to try to lessen the impact of that story. We at PolitiFact are one of five fact-checkers in the United States who are doing this. This is also happening in Germany and France. And we've debunked, I think it's close to more than 2,000 articles so far as being fake. And hopefully, you're not going to necessarily see our work because you're not going to see those stories. But if you did run across it, you would see a disputed label on that post in the Facebook newsfeed that would say, this story, the Pope endorsed Donald Trump, has been disputed by PolitiFact, and you should share it or read it with caution. Of course, any user can still read it, click on it, like it, whatever they want, but they get that now additional information that fact checkers have said, be careful, this is likely not correct.
That could be a game changer this year.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm skeptical of people using even fact-based stories and information, you know, to sort of improve their knowledge about something. But
you are conveying a real lack of, confidence in the American people right now.
Apparently I am. I didn't even realize it, but that's been kind of like the whole podcast so far. So I apologize to you, American people.
One last question for you, Aaron. We're in an environment where we have a president of the United States who actively engages in the idea that what the news media puts out is fake. Is Donald Trump good for PolitiFact's business or bad for PolitiFact's business?
Well, yeah, it's a good question. I would start by saying that it has been challenging. It's challenging for us when the president of the United States labels huge portions of what I would consider mainstream factual news, fake news. It dilutes the word, it dilutes the process, and it kind of puts us at a disadvantage because we spend every day trying to be as fair and objective as possible. If we do something wrong, we correct it. We actually have a whole corrections page where if someone wants to see all the times we screwed up, they can look them all up. And for someone to dismiss that work so quickly, I think is a disservice. Now that said, of course, I think the president, by creating this us versus them kind of mentality, has made people choose a side. And so if the president says something wrong, there's a lot of people who are going to come and see our fact check and cheer, I suppose. But we saw that. We see that all the time. I mean, quite frankly, during the Democratic primary in 2016, the Hillary Clinton supporters liked when we said Bernie Sanders said something wrong. And the Bernie voters would like when we said something Hillary said was wrong, but they didn't cross over. So we do have this problem of weaponization of fact checks that I think we have to work on to help people better understand that we're just trying to put the best information out there. We're not necessarily calling someone a liar. We're not saying that they're not trustworthy, but we just want you to have the best information to make the best decision possible. And so, yeah, fact checking is in vogue now. Everyone is doing it. I think the president, quite frankly, is one reason why, but not the only.
Aaron, thank you so much for joining us. It's been really helpful, and I think, I'm looking around the table, I think we all learned something from you today.
Aaron, thanks. That was fascinating.
Awesome. Great to be here.
That was a good interview.
It was terrific.
Now it's time for my favorite part, the lightning round. And because Ben is new, you have to go first. Ben Weider.
I'm ready. So one candidate I'd be looking for in 2018 for the potential for fake ads and bots is Senator Claire McCaskill in Missouri. She's considered already to be arguably the most vulnerable Democrat in the Senate. And as we know, when you look at some of the topics that these ads focused on, whether it be Black Lives Matter, immigration, these are very important issues in Missouri. Missouri, of course, is home to Ferguson, which is kind of associated most closely with the Black Lives Matter movement. So I would be paying close attention to Claire McCaskill's re-election bid to try to see if the Russians are trying to influence 2018.
Not much lightning in that answer, but definitely relevant to the topic. So well done. Alex Rorty.
I'm going to go to the Bernie faction in the Democratic Party. It's a huge week. Donna Brazile, over the weekend, Politico published an excerpt from her book. She basically took a flamethrower to Hillary Clinton and the Democratic establishment, reignited these claims that the DNC primary last year was rigged. If that weren't enough, now we have a gubernatorial election in Virginia on Tuesday. And if the Democratic nominee, Ralph Northam, doesn't win, the Bernie faction is going to claim we were right again and we were screwed. And now we're taking over the party.
And playing the role of Katie Glick, I am going with Mark Meadows, who is a Republican from North Carolina. He is the chairman of the House Freedom Caucus. And while a caucus cannot endorse, he is going to be leading the effort to get caucus members to weigh in on 2018. They're going to throw their weight behind 8 to 10 conservatives in races next year. All right, that's it for us. Thank you so much, Alex Rorty.
It was lovely to be here as always.
And Ben Weider, thank you for joining us, and I hope you will do it again.
Thank you. This was fantastic.
Thank you to our executive producer, Davin Coburn, and thank you to our listeners. We want to hear from you, so please send us your questions and your comments to btb@mcclatchy.com. Tell us what you're seeing in your battleground state. Check us out on Apple Podcasts, TuneIn, Stitcher, or whatever podcast app you use. Leave us a review. Tell us what you think. Talk to you next week. Ben, welcome to your first podcast.
Thank you.
We hope you do really well.
Thank you. I'm excited.
If you don't, we're not going to invite you back.
I can imagine.
Emily Cadet was in tears at the end of last week's episode.
I actually did think she sounded great.
Yeah, she did.
She was fantastic.
You'll get to choose between Ben Weider and Alex Rorty.
All right. Well, you get to audition for it, man.
You get two chances.
Yeah. Okay.
Just be honest in the moment.
Just feel it.
If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to listen to them.
Nope. Do it again. Act like you're really excited and caffeinated. Okay. Do the Grip Gordon.
If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them.
Welcome to Beyond the Bubble. Ready?
Let's do it. If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them.
That's pretty good.
You want to try one more time?
I've had a lot of practice.
You want to try one more time?
If Washington wants to get it right with voters.
Get it right with voters?
Get right with. Did I say get it?
Yes, you
said get it right.
Let me do it again. If Washington wants to get right with voters, it has to start listening to them.
I like that one.
He's just got that Liev Schreiber voice.
Yeah.
You can't mess with that, dude. Like, that's just...
Yeah.